Good morning. Welcome to the U.S. Institute of Peace. My name is Daniel Serwer. I'm the Vice President for Peace and Stability Operations here, and it is indeed an enormous pleasure to welcome Jim Locker and Jim Dobbins to this session on ensuring security in an unpredictable world, the urgent need for national security reform. It's obviously a particularly appropriate moment to be discussing national security reform, not only because of the situation of the world, but because of the situation in Washington, which is, I suppose, could be described as ripe for change. So we look forward to hearing the two Jims. I don't do long biographical introductions. I think the biographies are both outside for your perusal, but I do try to say something personal about our speakers. And in this case, Jim Locker is somebody I know. Many of you may know him from his background with Goldwater Nichols, but I don't. I know him as the man who brought defense sector reform to Bosnia. And I asked him earlier, which was harder, defense sector reform in Bosnia or national security sector reform in the United States? And he ducked the question. I suspect that the U.S. is a little bit harder. He certainly has mounted an enormous effort with hundreds of participants in a way that seems to me to represent the best of style in Washington, which is to get together people from both sides of the aisle and try to work on the problems and not worry too much about the politics until implementation time, which has arrived. And hopefully this openness to both sides of the aisle will help with the implementation process. And Jim has told me he plans to stick with that over the next year. I don't remember the first time I met Jim Dobbins, but his record of distinguished service in conflict zones, in almost every conflict zone that we've been engaged in over the last couple of decades, is notable. There's nobody with deeper experience on those issues, and I confess that once upon a time I used to think of him as the ambassador to the EU in Brussels. So he has a very broad background and will comment on Jim Locker's presentation. Jim Locker, the floor is yours.
Well, thank you. I'm delighted to be here to talk about national security reform and the report that we released on the 3rd of December, forging a new shield. National security reform is the number one national security issue. And there are many, many people in Washington who believe that's the case. And you may be looking at me saying, how in the world can he say that with all of the other issues, Iraq, Afghanistan, North Korea, Iran, combating terrorism? But the reason that I and so many other people in Washington believe that this is the number one issue is because our ability to perform in all of these other more specific national security issues is tremendously undermined by our organizational dysfunction, both on the policy formulation side, but most critically on the policy implementation side. And this is a great moment to make changes, a new administration coming in. And I'll talk about that in a moment. I'd like to make three introductions. Francis Hardin, the press secretary of the Project on National Security Reform, is here with me. One of our greatest spokespersons is here, and Larry Wilkerson. Larry had raised money for us early in the project when it was really critical, and whenever he speaks out, things happen for the Project on National Security Reform, and it's great to see him here. And I also want to recognize Michelle Van Cleve, who is one of our case study authors. Wrote a very powerful case study that's in the first volume that we published on the counterintelligence executive. So delighted to see you, Michelle. Our effort was mandated by Congress. There was a provision in the Defense Authorization Bill requiring this study. It's been an effort that's been underway for 2 years. We formally submitted it on the 26th of November to the President, the President-elect, and the congressional leadership. As you know, the theme of change dominated politics this year. But at the top of any agenda of change must be national security reform. National security is the government's number one responsibility, and the system that we currently have is completely misaligned with 21st century threats and opportunities. Our government is dominated by rigid, bureaucratic, competitive, vertically oriented departments and agencies. But the problems that we're facing today require that we work horizontally across the government, that we have the ability to integrate the expertise and capabilities of many departments and agencies. What we need is the ability to have effective horizontal teams, both for policy formulation and for policy implementation. We do not have that. And the way I like to describe it is we have horizontal problems and a vertical government. And if you didn't like what's happened recently, you're not going to like what's coming in the future, given our current organizational arrangements. Now, the first thing I should mention is that this critique of the national security system is not focused on the skills and dedication of people who are working in the system. Our national security professionals are highly skilled and they're incredibly dedicated. They're really working with unsurpassed dedication. The problem that we have is much of their hard work is absolutely wasted by the organizational dysfunction. When I was an Assistant Secretary of Defense for Special Operations and Low Intensity Conflict, and we were tremendously dependent upon the interagency system, and to just try to make little things happen, the workload was crushing. And that's the case in many, many places. The Project on National Security Reform is a private-public partnership. We have lots of people from government who are working on it. Most of the people are from outside of government with lots of government expertise. We had a guiding coalition of 26 members. It's gotten smaller because that's the bad news. The good news is that they've gone on to key positions in the Obama-Biden transition. Jim Jones, who has been selected to be the National Security Advisor, was part of our guiding coalition. Michelle Flournoy, who's gone into the defense transition team, Ash Carter, Jim Steinberg, rumored to be the Deputy Secretary of State. They're all members of our guiding coalition, and you've heard the rumor maybe that Denny Blair is a leading candidate to be the Director of National Intelligence. He was my deputy as part of the project. So in our view, we have the sense that we're well-positioned with people who've spent the last 2 years studying these particular issues and now will be in a position where they can advance lots of the ideas. We've had more than 300 national security professionals working on our project. We've done 106 case studies. The one that I mentioned that Michelle Van Cleave did is one of our best. We've printed 10 of those in a volume that's available. And I guess the next thing I should say is we see national security reform having two phases. The first phase is how do we get it addressed at the interagency level, that space between the departments and the president. We have to figure out how we're going to operate at the highest level of the government. And then in the second phase, we have to figure out what aligning reforms need to take place in the departments and agencies themselves. And all of the departments and agencies will need some tremendous reforms to be prepared for the 21st century threats. In recent years, there's been compelling evidence that our system is not working well. the terrorist attacks of 9/11, the troubled stability operations in Iraq and Afghanistan, the poor response to Hurricane Katrina. These are not coincidental setbacks. They're evidence of a system failure. But our organizational performance has been troubled for many decades. It's just that two things have happened to expose our organizational weaknesses. One is the world has become much more complex, and second, it is moving at a much faster pace. And that complexity and speed has really brought out the deficiency of our vertical orientation and our inability to work horizontally. And if you think about it, and this is a frightening conclusion, but something that we're convinced of, the gap between our capacities and the speed of our government and the demands that are being placed upon the national security system is widening. The world is changing much faster than our ability to adapt. Now, I'd like to talk about the problems. The methodology we had in the Project on National Security Reform is determine what's wrong and what's causing it before you start to think about solutions. And we probably spent 90% of our time on that subject. What is wrong with this system and why? Washington is normally too impatient to do that kind of disciplined work. We want to know what the answers are, and often we go out and we look at structural answers. And if you look at the reforms that have been recently enacted, Department of Homeland Security, the Office of the Director of National Intelligence, the National Counterterrorism Center, they're all structural reforms. And what we've done is we've created structural shells, but they're not effective organizations. The foremost problem that we have in our system is it's grossly imbalanced. It has very strong departments and almost no integrating mechanism. The integrating mechanisms that we have are the National Security Council and staff and the Homeland Security Council and staff. But there are headquarters, but they're tiny, and they have no headquarters powers. They're advisory in total. And at a time in which we need incredibly tight integration across our government, you know, if you just thought about combating terrorism, we need the Department of Justice involved for the law enforcement dimension. We need state involved because we're working through the UN and with lots of countries. We need the Defense Department involved for the our effort to find the terrorists. We have almost all of the elements of the intelligence community involved. We need Treasury because we're trying to stem the flow of finances to terrorists. We need transportation because I'd like to strike at transportation networks. We need the Health and Human Services because we're worried about biological chemical and the medical challenges of any large terrorist event. And that's just the beginning to get a sense of how are we going to integrate across when we're vertically oriented, we can't work with each other, we don't even have any interagency doctrine, and we don't have anybody other than the president who can integrate this system. So that's our first challenge. And this problem really had its seeds in the National Security Act of 47. Which got almost no attention from the Congress. The 1947 Act was dominated by the issue of military unification, and this was really a backwater. It set up this system that was only advisory and put all of the burdens on the president. Related to this is that all of the personnel incentives are designed to reinforce this departmental orientation. You are rewarded, you're promoted, you're expected to go to that interagency table and defend the interest of your department. Recently, since our reports come out, I've been briefing throughout Washington Hill, Capitol Hill, and in executive departments and agencies. And when I talked about people from the departments going to the interagency table to defend the interests of the department, one of the briefings I gave, and I won't mention what department it was in, but a deputy assistant secretary said I had defended him, that he had never gone to an interagency meeting without thinking of the national interest. And he was certain that I had offended everybody else. Then there were like 15 senior people from this department because he was certain they had never gone. Well, fortunately, as we got into this discussion on this issue, the senior person from that department in attendance said to him, yes, but when you go there, do you always think it is our instrument that ought to have the highest priority? And he stopped for a moment and he said, "Well, now that you mention it, yes." And the fellow said, "I think we're into a little substitution here where you substituted the interest for our department for the national interest." But in many cases, when I was an assistant secretary of defense in the first Bush administration, the standing orders in the Department of Defense were not to cooperate with the interagency. It was, don't tell them anything, don't let them interfere with our operations, and whatever you do, don't let them get their hands on our money. Some other problems in the system. A huge problem is that we do not manage the national security system as a system. And part of that is because it is such a dysfunctional system that all of the energy has to go into working the problems of today and tomorrow. So there's nobody sitting back who's looking at the entire system. We don't develop strategic guidance for the system. We don't do macro resource allocation. We don't assess the performance of the system from a system-wide perspective. All of the assessments are done in the departmental stovepipes. We don't do knowledge management. You know, the government knows a tremendous amount. It just can't get it to the point of application. So we don't have anybody who's worrying about where is the information and ensuring we get it to the point. We don't manage our human capital resources from an interagency perspective. So all of the system management things are not done. But most crippling is the lack of strategic guidance because it denies us unity of purpose. It is hard to imagine that in this system we do not at the national level do any strategic planning or any visioning. The documents that are produced, the strategy documents, are not strategy documents. They're public relations documents. They're goal-oriented. There's nobody in the government who picks that up and says, okay, now I know what I'm going to do and how I'm going to go about it. There is also another problem that issues tend to be over-centralized in the White House. You know, many presidents come in and say, I'm going to decentralize. I'm not going to be like the last group. I'm going to get back to the departments and agencies. So they push it back to the departments and agencies. But when they do that, they find that the departments and agencies, no matter how hard they work, do not have a presidential perspective. They're not working at it from the national level. And so then the White House, after some stumbling, pulls the issues back. But then they become a bottleneck. They can only handle three issues. Recently, after Mumbai, you know, the whole national security team, that's all they did for a week or more was focus on the situation in India and Pakistan. And so we have this problem that the White House gets overburdened, can only handle a few issues. The next problem is that resources are not aligned with strategic objectives. The Office of Management and Budget puts the President's budget together based upon inputs, departmental inputs. It's not based upon here are our strategic objectives, here are the missions the President wants to see performed. And so we're not looking at that whole budget, making those kinds of trade-offs that are necessary. And that's why we end up with the imbalances that we have with all the money going to the Pentagon and the civilian parts of the government resource constrained, unable to perform their national security missions. Then the last problem, the Congress. The Congress is as stovepiped as the executive branch. Matter of fact, it's worse because it never had its own National Security Act of 1947. So it has those narrow committee jurisdictions, and it can focus on the parts, but it cannot do whole of government. It does not have the ability. And if you think of the world that we're facing, where we need to integrate across the departments, we need a Congress, a House and a Senate, who can have that perspective, who can see how the parts need to fit together, who can figure out how to empower the interagency space and how to oversee it. And that does not exist today. In our project, we have 38 recommendations, major recommendations, and they fit into seven themes. And what I'm going to do, I can't tell you about all 38. I'd love to be able to do that. But I'm going to talk about the seven themes, and then I'll give some highlight recommendations from those themes. Our very first theme, and probably our most important, is that the focus now needs to be on national missions and national outcomes. And that will require a lot more integrated effort, it will require a lot more collaboration, and it will require a lot more agility. And one of the first things that we've done is we've broadened the scope of national security. If you look at the National Security Council today, it has four statutory members: the President, the Vice President, the Secretary of State, and the Secretary of Defense. Recently, the Secretary of Energy was added at the very end of the last Congress. But it has the statutory advisors, the Chairman, the Joint Chiefs of Staff, and now the Director of National Intelligence. It really has the World War II model of what national security was: diplomacy, military, and intelligence. And so we broadened the scope of national security beyond security from aggression to think about security against massive societal disruption as a result of natural forces, whether they're pandemics or climate change. And then we also are looking security against the failure of major national infrastructure systems, whether it's a cyber attack or what else it might be. And then importantly, we understand that if the nation is going to be secure, it has to have sustained stewardship of the foundations of national power. Sound economic policy, energy security, more attention to the economic or to the educational dimension, the technological parts, and so we would expect much more attention to these subjects as well. Another major idea as part of this national this focus on national missions and outcomes is that we're proposing that the National Security Council and the Homeland Security Council be merged into one council. And to signify that it's different from what we've had in the past, we call it the President's Security Council. But not only would it work on international and homeland security issues, but we would expect it would take up both the economic and energy issues that have security implications. We're also proposing essentially that the National Security Advisor be replaced with somebody known as the Director for National Security, an empowered National Security Advisor. We have in mind that this position can no longer be advisory. You know, we cannot have, if the overarching framework has to be national security, it's no longer the components. They're just part of something we have to do at a higher level. And the president can't do it all. The president will need somebody who is a national security manager. So we're talking about going from a national security advisor to a national security manager who will be the principal assistant to the president on all matters related to national security. So those are a few ideas of our recommendations in that first theme. The second theme is to create unity of purpose across the whole national security system. And there we have in mind focusing the President's Security Council staff and the President's Security Council and anybody else who's in the executive office of the president, focusing them on high policy, grand strategy, and strategic system management, all of the things they're not doing today. Get them up, and that's the place where that has got to originate. Make the president the grand strategist, provide support for him to do that. And as part of this, we would mandate every 4 years a national security review. Does not need to be done by a cast of thousands as the quadrennial defense review is done. You know, 10 or 15 people working on this subject can do this review. And annually, the president would issue national security planning guidance to all of the departments and agencies, like the defense planning guides, but go out to every department that has a role in national security, in which the president lays out his strategic objectives, the missions he wants performed, and whatever other guidance he has for them. Then I mentioned this issue that we don't do strategic system management. And there is the one official in the National Security Council system who is specified in law as the executive secretary. And we're proposing that the executive secretary be shifted from his current duties, which are much more administrative in nature, to doing the system management. And so this office would make certain that we were doing strategic planning, that we were out there doing some visioning work, that the macro resource allocation work is done, that we have the ability to assess performance of the system from a system-wide perspective. The executive secretary would manage an interagency personnel system, and anything else that needed to be done would be done by the executive secretary. So the third theme is decentralization. Decentralization of national of the management of national security issues, and we also have in mind getting unity of effort by both creating interagency teams and, when the situation demands it, an interagency crisis task force. If we have in mind that we're going to have the executive office of the president get focused on high policy, grand strategy, and strategic system management, then who's going to do the day-to-day issue management work that currently consumes those people? And there we have in mind it has to be decentralized. The world is moving way too fast for some central organization to be able to monitor what's going on and think through the issues. And we think that needs to be done in something other than interagency committees. The current interagency committee structure, because people are there to represent the departments and agencies, they have a tendency to come to lowest common denominator outcomes, takes them very long to do it, and we also don't have any standing means of implementing policy. So we think all of this needs to be done by interagency teams, and we're proposing this get started by having the president select five or seven high-priority issues that he would assign to interagency teams. So how are teams different than committees? Well, teams are designed to have only one mission, not to defend the interest of their department. What is it that the nation needs? They bring their expertise from the departments, but they have no obligation to defend departmental ideology. And so they would, the president would designate somebody to be known as a national security executive, a very senior person who would be given a presidential mandate to go off and work on this issue. Maybe resources are assigned. This national security executive would select the team based upon the expertise that's required. The team would have to go through some team training, hopefully before they're called to duty on a team, but to prepare them for operating in a very different fashion than we do today. This is a huge idea, must happen in the United States government. We cannot afford to be brokering the perspectives of different departments and agencies in a world that needs fast responses and effective responses. So we're starting with a minor idea on these interagency teams. When they prove their success, that it'll spread like wildfire, and we'll be doing it in regions. We're hoping to turn the country teams, which we already call teams, but aren't except when we have incredibly capable ambassadors. They're not teams because all of the feuding from Washington just gets translated down into those country teams and make the role of the ambassador impossible. For crises where we need a task force, an interagency task force, we're proposing that there be one integrated chain of command. You know, currently we have two chains of command, a military chain of command and a civilian chain of command. And we're proposing, and this will take some work to figure out how to do it, but in the future there'll just be one chain of command. When the security situation demands it, it'll be headed by a military person. When the situation permits, a civilian will head it with the military in a subordinate position. So that was theme number three. Theme number four is, how are we going to get our resources linked to our objectives? And there I mentioned the president will sign out this national security planning guidance, which will tell the departments and agencies, here's what I want you to do. And then they're going to be asked to put together a six-year budget projection, which the President's Security Council will play the lead role in reviewing. OMB may do much of the work, but we want the security people really driving the review of that to see that those budgets are consistent with the President's, or compatible with the President's guidance. And this is where the trade-offs would be made. We're proposing that one integrated national security budget be created, with the ability to trade off between all of those accounts so that we actually balance across the instruments of national power, looking at what missions we're planning to achieve. And then this integrated national security budget with mission budget displays will be sent to the Congress. It will not be the document they would operate on. They'll still get their current appropriations categories, but it'll be there to inform them and ought to be very helpful to inform the budget committees on Capitol Hill. Our fifth recommendation theme, is to align personnel incentives with strategic objectives. As I'd mentioned today, they're all of the incentives are running against what the nation needs. So first of all, we'll have a human capital strategic plan for the interagency system. We'll create a national security professional corps of people who are especially oriented and trained for service in the interagency space. We'll use promotion requirements to create incentives for people to go to interagency assignments. You cannot be promoted to SES or SIS or some other high level in the government unless you've successfully completed interagency assignment. And we'll put a lot more effort into strengthening education and training programs for interagency. Everybody who goes to an embassy staff will have to go through team training on team dynamics and conflict resolution before they go off, and it will be hugely important. If they're going to operate like teams, they need to be trained to in that regard. The sixth theme is to improve the flow of knowledge and information. As I mentioned, in our government, we have lots of ways in which we're not able to get information to where it's required. Most of them are cultural. You know, we don't trust other people. We're not certain exactly what they're going to do with the information we're about to give them. We know they're not going to keep it as secure as we would if we held on to it. But so our idea is that the President's Security Council will have a chief knowledge officer who will work on this issue of what are the barriers, making certain that we get the flow of information we need. We're proposing to have a single security classification system for the entire national security system. So every department having its own little classification scheme, we're proposing to end that. That'll take some work to do, but if we are going to be effective, able to react rapidly, propose ideas with speed, that will be required. We're also planning to consolidate the security clearance process as well. Just a little story. When I was an assistant secretary of defense, I had a badge that got me in anywhere except for the National Defense University. You know, they had their own little badge system, and I wasn't recognized there, and so I had to be escorted every moment I was over there. And this is a problem that we have throughout the system. And if we want people working in teams going back and forth, these kinds of things will have to change. I've saved the best for last, the Congress. You know, how are we going to build a better partnership between the legislative branch and the executive branch? Well, our key idea there is on Capitol Hill, we have to create that interagency team that we're looking for in the executive branch, a team of something that we're calling the Select Committee on National Security in the House and in the Senate. And it would be made up of the chairman and ranking members of those committees with national security jurisdiction or their designees. And it's the same idea we have of these interagency teams. We need the expertise from the standing committees, but we need this team that's up there focused on the interagency space, and the interagency space is where the really important things are going to happen in the future. There are going to be a lot more organizations in that interagency space. You can already see it started. You know, the Strategic Operational Planning Directorate out at the National Counterterrorism Center, Joint Task Force South, the Coast Guard has created a deployable operations group. There, you know, people understand it's got to be integrated. So we're talking to the Congress about creating the jurisdiction they do not currently have. We're also looking to strengthen the two foreign policy committees. The Senate Foreign Relations Committee and the House Foreign Affairs Committee do not pass annual authorization bills. I don't know how many times I've done it in the last 20 years, two or three times or whatever. When I was on the Senate Armed Services Committee, there was no authorization bill coming out of the Senate Foreign Relations Committee. So all of the foreign policy issues were addressed in the Armed Services Committee. And so we went to a conference with the House Armed Services Committee, and we decided everything that was important. In this world in which we need to give a lot more attention to soft power, getting an annual authorization bill out of those two committees would be hugely important. So we're thinking about measures to strengthen that, creating firewalls that prevent money from being moved out of the international affairs account, requiring in the House that there be a supermajority before the requirement for an authorization bill, before an appropriations bill, could be waived. You know, we're thinking of all of the means that we could actually make it much more likely that we'd have an authorization bill out of the two foreign policy committees. Then the last thing I wanted to mention is we need a lot more flexibility from the Congress on funding. A much bigger contingency fund available to the president with means of getting it from the congressional leadership quickly, more flexibility in reprogramming and transfers of funds. The world is changing too fast for us to be able to predict exactly how we're going to need to spend our money. So we need some flexibility so that we can respond. Now, the last thing I'll mention before we hear from Ambassador Dobbins is the Project on National Security Reform has three sets of reforms in mind, an executive order and presidential directives. The president-elect could begin a new system on January 21st. It wouldn't have all of the bells and whistles. It wouldn't be permanent because it would depend upon being sustained by those who follow. But much of what needs to be done can be done within existing authority. Our second set of reforms are amendments to the rules of the House and the Senate. And this Select Committee on National Security is at the top of that list. And then the third thing we have is in mind is a new National Security Act. And we're off working hard on all of those. Anyway, that's our story, and I look forward later to answering any questions you might have.
Thank you, Jim. Mr. Ambassador.
Thank you. Well, first of all, I think we all owe a debt of gratitude to Jim Locker and the large team that supported him for harnessing the widespread dissatisfaction in Washington and beyond with the way our government was currently operating and channeling that in a constructive and bipartisan manner. And I think the timing is right. There is a feeling that we can do better, and I think that his report is full of constructive proposals to do better. I find myself in the odd position of agreeing with most of his conclusions without agreeing with his most fundamental premise. That is to say, I'm less pessimistic than Jim about the capacity of the current system to produce and implement good policy. I tend to think that a system that allowed us to win the Cold War, unify Germany, liberate Eastern Europe, deal with the collapse of the Soviet Union, stabilize the Balkans, win a war in Afghanistan in 10 weeks, and put a new government into Kabul 2 weeks thereafter, a system that was running pretty well 5 years ago, can't be completely broken today. And I make a distinction between bad policy, bad process, and bad institutions. And I do think that most, not all, but most of the problems that we've encountered, particularly in the first term of the current administration, had to do with bad policy and to some degree bad process as opposed to inadequate institutions. We now know in retrospect that the decision to go to war in Iraq and the early occupation was badly flawed, and this was flawed as the result of bad policy and to some degree bad process. We now know that the president never asked his Secretary of State, his Secretary of Defense, or the director of the CIA whether or not to invade Iraq. And he didn't do that not because somebody in the NSC forgot to schedule a meeting or because the institution wasn't capable of conducting such a debate. He did it because he didn't want to have such a debate. And I'm not sure there's any institutional change that could have overcome that particular debility. Similarly, the occupation of Iraq was mishandled, largely because the president delegated his responsibilities for integrating the efforts of civilian and military capabilities in the government to the Secretary of Defense, rather than keeping those responsibilities in the White House and forcing state defense, treasury, et cetera, to cooperate. I think if you I put most of this in the first term, because if you look at the way, for instance, the president reached the decision on the surge at the beginning of 2007, it's in stark contrast to the way he reached the decision to go to war in the first place. He engaged an interagency process. There was an intense debate. He engaged the Joint Chiefs of Staff. There was an intense debate. He engaged people outside the government. He finally made a decision that disagreed with many of them, but every one of them had a chance to shape that decision and participate in it. And if you look at the way the decision was executed in the field, we did achieve an integration of civilian and military capabilities of state and defense and other agencies in Iraq, which was totally missing 3 or 4 years earlier. So the current system can be made to work, but that doesn't mean it can't be made better. And I think probably most of the suggestions that Jim and his group has made will allow it to function better. Rand seconded some people who worked with Jim on his effort, and Rand has also done some separate work on the subject along somewhat parallel lines. We published a study just a few weeks ago called After the War, Nation Building from FDR to George W. Bush, which looked at the manner in which presidential personality, interagency structures, and decision-making processes affected the outcomes in American nation-building expeditions from Germany and Japan after the Second World War through Iraq today. And the main conclusion of that book is that that some administrations are better at this than others. And when I say this, I cite nation-building because it is probably the most difficult single task in the national security realm, because it does require this blending of capacity from across the government. You know, winning a war essentially only takes one agency. Winning the peace takes multiple agencies and puts much greater pressures on the White House decision-making processes than the actual conventional combat phase. Some administrations are better than this than others, but all of them get better over time. And then that increased capacity doesn't transmit to their successors. There are abrupt discontinuities as you move from one administration to another, particularly as you move between administrations and between parties at the same time. And that therefore, if you're looking at how to fix this problem, how to increase our capacity to conduct these kinds of operations, focusing on the transitions is a good place to start, because that's where you'll get the greatest payoff, because that's where the greatest discontinuities in acquired capacity tend to drop off. And some of the things that I'd suggest in this book are consistent with what Jim is proposing, I think. I think it would be useful to legislate a division of labor between state, defense, and the other major agencies in this field, so that each administration didn't have complete freedom to redistribute functions. No agency is going to invest in a capability if it doesn't know that it's going to have to perform it for an extended period of time. And the way we bounce things like police training back between state and defense every 2 years demotivates everybody from making the investments necessary to do that better. I do think that to his idea of a national security professional corps, and in particular the requirement that anybody who wants to be promoted into the senior foreign service, the senior executive service, the senior intelligence service, should have served at least one tour in an interagency position or in another agency, is a reasonable requirement that could be imposed without too much difficulty. And we also recommend in this particular volume that we reverse the growth in the number of political appointees in order to build up the capacity and professionalism of our career service. In terms of the philosophy underlying the reforms that some of which Jim has proposed, I have a slightly different optic on it. I think there are three levels of if you will, of oversight and execution that need to be thought of as distinct, and to the extent possible need to be assigned to different levels of government. I think there's policy direction and policy coordination at the broadest level. I think that has to be done in the White House. I think only the president can compel state, defense, and the other agencies to follow a single policy line. And I don't think that can be delegated, although he can empower his staff to assist him in that process. So I think policy coordination should continue, as it has, to be a White House function, and I don't think it can be delegated to a given agency in cases where multiple agency commitment is required at a high level. Then I think there's programmatic coordination. It's making sure that every program the United States is conducting all converge in support of the designated policies. I see that as primarily a State Department function. It's the role the ambassador plays in the country team to make sure everybody on his team is implementing the programs that they're funded to implement in a way that converges on that country. And I think at the regional level, that's essentially a State Department function. And then you have program implementation, that is actually taking the money and using it for something. And I think that should not be a State Department function. I think the State Department's doing too much of that. And I would prefer to see those functions farmed out to other agencies, principally AID in the nation building field, but not exclusively. I think my model for the way that program implementation as opposed to program coordination should work is the way we've always handled security assistance, which is the money goes to the State Department. The State Department makes the broad policy decisions of how much money we're going to give Colombia and what kind of equipment, and then the Defense Department executes that. Now, the Defense Department obviously has a role in setting the policy, and the state has some oversight of the execution. But the division is clear, and each agency, by virtue of the way the money is handled, has a clear set of responsibilities. And I would do the same for AID. I would move all the execution functions in the State Department back to AID. AID should be doing police training, not state. AID should be using refugee assistance, not state. AID should be doing the Millennium Development Account, not the Millennium Development Corporation. AID should be doing assistance in AIDS. All of these things should be moved back into AID. If we moved all those things back to AID, AID would be as big as it was 30 years ago without our spending a single extra dime. And you'd have an agency that was much more robust and capable of surging to meet particular crises because it would have a much larger catchment of expertise and money available to it. But I would have the Congress provide that money to the State Department. So the State Department would decide what programs to implement, would pass the money, and AID would implement them. I mean, that's my conceptual scheme for how to divide those functions and assign those responsibilities. I do believe that the National Security Council staff should remain should retain the primacy that it generally holds. I'm not sure I would combine them. I mean, I'd really rather have Larry Summer than Jim Jones dealing with the current financial services crisis. But I would certainly, in issues that clearly required both, give primacy to the National Security Council while allowing the Homeland Security Council and the International Economic Council to continue to function autonomously on issues that only required a minimal degree of oversight from the pure national security side. But I do think integration is important. I haven't had a chance to go through the 700-page report. I've only listened to Jim, and I did read the summary, and I think there's a very rich menu of terrific ideas there. As I said, I would approach them philosophically a little differently, but I think most of the concrete proposals fit as well into my scheme as into Jim's.
Thank you very much, Jim. We've got two microphones set up for people who want to make comments or ask questions, and I invite you to line up at those. Bob Beecroft, you may as well start us off. Introduce yourself.
Bob Beecroft, 37 years in the State Department, now with MPRI. Dan Serwer's successor, but never his equal on the Bosnia account. Question for Jim Locker. You, and this has to do with, guess what, the State Department. You talked about an integrated national security budget, which makes sense to me. But I'm interested in your definition of how that applies to the Department of State. You know the Hill a lot better than I ever will. Is the Department of State to be included in this national security universe? And I ask that because it's currently parked with Justice and Commerce in the 150 account, which has been an Achilles heel every time the Department of State has tried to be seen in the national security context as the as comparable to defense and other agencies that are agreed by everybody to be national security agencies. Are you thinking of perhaps transferring State to the 050 account along with the Department of Defense, or redefining how the budgetary structure will be approached on the Hill? State at present basically has an Achilles heel that no one has ever managed to resolve, and of course with committee prerogatives that just makes it worse.
Right.
So how do you handle that?
Well, our view is that the State Department budget would be in this integrated national security budget. And that's the, you know, fixing the budget issue has to be done by the president. It has to be done in OMB. It's not going to be done by Capitol Hill. You know, the Congress, for the most part, is in the margin of the president's budget. So we have in mind this idea of an integrated budget that would have the State Department included. And as we do those mission analyses, figure out what are the missions we want to perform and what are the capabilities that give us the best chance of achieving our mission goals. That's where we make those trade-offs and determine how we balance across military and the non-military elements of the budget. And that's our effort to really look at the civilian capacity issue to get it fixed there. Now, there's one other recommendation affecting the State Department that I did not mention. As you may know, there are lots of foreign policy programs that are executed by other departments and agencies. And because of the lack of coordination of those in Washington, it almost makes it impossible for an ambassador to have a coherent program. So we're proposing that a very hard look be taken at these programs where they exist. There, you know, lots of the aid things have been started elsewhere, and some of those need to be consolidated in the Department of State. If they're clearly within the State Department's core competencies, they ought to go there. To the extent to which they ought to remain in other departments and agencies, we're proposing that a horizontal team be created under the leadership of the Secretary of State to put together a coherent, you know, foreign policy plan and programs for the United States. We also have in mind that the Foreign Service would be expanded to include those cadres in other departments and agencies who are essentially doing these foreign policy programs elsewhere. And this is just one idea that we have of strengthening the role of the Department of State.
Jim Dobbins, did you want to comment? Beth.
Hi. I want to thank you for taking on this task. I think, despite the fact that some people think that Iraq and Afghanistan...
Beth, you got to talk close to the microphone, even
well,
if it's
like
too...
it's like so high.
Yeah, well,
I think some people are thinking that maybe Iraq and Afghanistan might be our last nation-building experiments. I disagree, and I think an enduring challenge for this administration and others will be to leverage these assets across the interagency to do these kind of operations. So I thank you for what you've done. I think that actually somewhere, and I agree with Ambassador Dobbins, somewhere between PDD 56 of the Clinton administration and NSPD 44 of the current administration and the structures that we've built in between, which aren't really captured in this executive summary, are where we need to start. I mean, I think that there's a lot that we have built that is good and that we should look at continuity as well as change. And that's my mantra. But I wanted to focus on a couple of recommendations here. If you could do nothing else but create a select committee on national security, we would all be better off. I mean, that's one of the problems, that we have these separate funding streams and authorities for all of these departments that we're trying to bring together. I'd be interested in what you think is the possibility of actually doing that. Having served on the Hill, I think that's a really big task. I also think that follows, what follows from that is an integrated national security budget, which would also be a tremendous improvement over what we have, and I'd be interested in how you think that might happen. And the other three things that I think are doable under your recommendations are this national security professional. I think some work has been done on that over the last couple of years. It should be built on. This national security unified information system, very, very critical. And also a national security assistant secretary level person in each department. The DOD directive 3000.05 called for an assistant secretary level person on stability operations. You're just saying it should be a national security person. I think that's a great recommendation. Where you lose me is on the National Security Council and the investments that you want to put in under the president. And some of them I see are statutory, others are not. They just say establish this, establish that, without any congressional legislation. And I mean, I don't know if you've sat down with some of these congressional staffers recently. I'm sure you have. But I don't think that, even if it's Obama or whoever it is, that they're going to be willing to put forward some kind of contingency fund or conflict response fund. We've been trying to get that for about 4 or 5 years. They view these as slush funds, and they don't trust a president or an NSC or whatever that establishment might be to implement those on behalf of the nation. And a lot of those other recommendations that follow that you have about the White House being the lead for this, I find, you know, interesting, and in a perfect world might work, but I don't think the Congress is ever going to let that happen. So anyway.
Let me see if I can remember all of those points and respond to them. Maybe I'll start with the ones at the end that are most fresh in my mind. With respect to this contingency fund, what we're proposing is that it not be made available to the president without the approval of the congressional leadership. We have in mind that a few members of the leadership on Capitol Hill, their approval would be required. But it's the kind of thing that if the president, in the midst of a crisis, could call them and ask for their approval, so that we still have congressional control over it, but it is in a lengthy procedure. At the time of the Kennedy administration, the president used to have, in today's dollars, a contingency fund available to him of $1.5 billion. Today, the president has a $25 million contingency fund, and so we're proposing that there has to be something made available for the president. You know, in those golden hours at the beginning of a crisis when there's no money or we're scrambling to find the money, it still would have congressional control, but it has to be a process that can work very, very rapidly. Now, on your concerns about this President's Security Council, and we don't specify the statutory membership of it, the reason we've decided, you know, there's a very artificial distinction between the National Security Council and the Homeland Security Council. That divide between foreign and domestic is really blurring. And we're chewing up a lot of talent going to these separate meetings. The staffs have to go to each other's meetings to make certain that everything is being examined. You know, the National Economic Council has been dormant for a while. We know that there's some discussion by the president-elect of having an Energy Security Council. And so our idea is as follows. If you actually sat down and you listed in statute everybody the president might want to have involved in some consideration of the President's Security Council, it could be a very long list. And what we're proposing is that the members not be specified in statute, but that the president decides, who do I need around this table to help me with this particular issue? And if it's an energy security issue, it's a different set of players than it might be if we're worried about North Korea or if we're worried about some homeland security issue. So we're proposing a much more flexible arrangement. There'll be a much larger cast of characters that will need to be prepared to meet the president's need. But to have the president identify, if it gets too large, the president will never use it. And if you look at the history, as administrations have gone on, there have been fewer and fewer meetings of the National Security Council. And so we're proposing something much more flexible, more designed to meet the president's needs, to get the right people around the table on a particular issue, that not be too large, seven or eight people. With respect to the issue of the Congress and this select committee, many of you may know that when the Homeland Security Committees were created on Capitol Hill, it was just an incredible jurisdictional battle. The benefit of this idea is that it has a huge return without much pain on Capitol Hill, because we're not talking about changing the jurisdictions of the standing committees. They'll be infringed upon a little bit if we have a personnel system, an interagency personnel system, but just slightly. Those standing committees can continue to do what they are doing. We're asking the Congress to do something it's currently not doing, to create that jurisdiction over the interagency space, the interagency system, the national security interagency system. And so I think it's something that is doable. But the moment I start talking about congressional reform, I can hear their knees knocking underneath the table because they're so worried about the battles. But we can... National security reform will be imperfect without fixing the Congress, because the people who want to still do their part of this will end run the system, go to Capitol Hill, you know, we'll now have committees putting prohibitions on this or that into law. And so we need somebody up on Capitol Hill who will reinforce this national security perspective. When Goldwater-Nichols was passed on Capitol Hill, the Congress also played a hugely important role in its vigorous oversight of implementation of Goldwater-Nichols. And the same thing will be required here. Not everybody will agree with these ideas, may feel threatened by them, so the Congress will have an important role to play in ensuring that what the law requires is actually what's happening. So we need that committee up there playing that important role. That's about half of your questions, but anyway.
Let me just answer the question about money and adequacy and flexibility. I was responsible one time or another for overseeing reconstruction in Somalia, Haiti, the Balkans, and Afghanistan. And there were two problems that arose. One was the adequacy of funding. Now, in the end, I think we always had adequate funding, but there was a lag. And the lag was brought about because the funding required a supplemental appropriation. And we didn't go for the supplemental until defense began to run low. And that takes a while. I mean, defense has such a large budget that it can run a war for 6 or 8 months before it actually has to go and ask for more money. Whereas the State Department's capacity to reprogram money to cover unforeseen contingencies tends to be more limited, and they run out of money in a few months. And so shortening that period and bringing forward the time when you go forward with a supplemental, I think, would do a lot. Not wait until defense needs the money, but go forward with the supplemental within a month or so of the actual contingency, I think would allow state to cover the gap in the non-military funding. The second is making sure that you have adequate flexibility and control of the money. And that only occurred in one time, which was in the Balkans, where Congress had already set up an account for reconstruction in the former Warsaw Pact, with it was generously funded, and the money was given to the State Department. And the State Department decided whether to give it to AID or Treasury or Agriculture or some contractor. In other words, the State Department decided how to spend the money. Most of it did go to AID, which was fine. But the State Department, it didn't get into an argument about with AID about whether it was going to do agricultural reform or tariff implementation or capacity building. It simply told them what they were going to do. And similarly with other agencies who were able to use these funds based on an allocation by state. And that worked perfectly satisfactorily and quite successfully, I think. And so to the degree to which you go for supplemental funding earlier and you and the Congress is willing to put this in a state-controlled account, which state then doles out to other implementing agencies, including for non-military tasks, DOD, for instance, military training, I think it's a workable system. And I think having the National Security Select Committee and other things would help in that regard.
I would only add that during the entire length of the Iraq and Afghanistan wars, the timing for supplementals has been entirely decided by the Department of Defense, really. And there have been periods, now happens to be one of them with respect to Afghanistan at least, that some of the civilian agencies have been extremely short.
Well, you know, I mean, the CPA ran Afghanistan for 14 months, and at the end of that 14 months, only 0.2% of the aid that had been voted by the Congress had been dispensed because of they didn't go for a supplemental. They invaded in March. They didn't go for a supplemental till November. They didn't get it till the end of the year, and then OMB screwed around for 6 months.
Please.
I'm Michelle Van Cleve, and Jim, thank you for mentioning the piece that I wrote for PNSR case study. I've enjoyed my participation in this project, and I'm at the microphone because I found it fascinating to listen to the presentation that you made, and then with the ambassador's comments and the contrasts between them struck me as important to comment on. I have the sense that the ambassador is making the argument that so much of what exists now has been tested, tried, and proven to be effective in many different circumstances in the national security system, and that one should acknowledge that and work to use it to achieve good in the future. The project had a very interesting methodology, however, that rather tested that proposition. And I thought that it was extraordinary that you began the project by doing a series of case studies. And the case studies tested whether that system, in fact, was one that would serve the nation's best interests. So drawing some conclusions from the case studies, I thought was a very fine methodology to test that proposition. And where I would draw the comparisons is I've had the opportunity to work for three different presidents from the White House and look at the national security execution from that biased perspective, I would say, or the president's perspective. And I think that there are particular areas where things may work just fine, given the existing system, but other areas where we really are highly deficient. And I would, in fact, cite my recent experience in counterintelligence as rather a poster child for where there is inadequate ability to integrate across departments and agencies to achieve strategic objectives. So in the area of counterintelligence, where we have the FBI in the lead with important responsibilities resident in CIA and the three military services, we have no effective means of integrating across those different regimes. And as a consequence, the United States remains vulnerable to foreign intelligence operations in ways that should be unacceptable in today's day and age, if indeed they ever were acceptable. So it may be the case that there are specific areas where the existing model, the existing national security infrastructure does not support what needs to be accomplished. And here I find the notion of creating a particular dedicated effort to identify what are those specific areas to ensure that there is budget and integration and support brought in those particular areas is something where this, if there is created a new national security committee within the Congress, that committee could speak to that jurisdiction. I guess I'm standing back saying I see some larger picture emerging from the discussion here this morning that says for budget reasons, for jurisdictional reasons of this committee, for this so-called discretionary or contingency fund on behalf of the president, there may be specific national level programs that need to be funded and organized and run as national level programs with the appropriate structure behind them. So strategic operational planning for the war on terrorism may itself, for example, be one of those programs. I don't pretend to know what all of them might be, but I think that the recommendations that PNSR is making lend themselves to that kind of a structure. And then as a question, I would throw out to the both of you an area where I think there is a very specialized interest and need in integration. I see we've discussed the need to have strategic level guidance, to have a national security decision-making system that enables wise presidential decisions, oversight of execution as several different areas where there needs to be integration across the national security system. Another one which you touched on, Jim, but I would love to hear more about, is in crisis management. Mm-hmm. Because when this administration first came to office, crisis management extremely early on became something that almost became a day-to-day preoccupation with the war on terrorism. In crisis management, I wonder if there is some way to look specifically at integration across departments and agencies. Today we have in the Defense Department the National Military Command Center, OSD, co-located for the first time with the NMCC, but there are still questions of how that relates to not only the State Department, but the Homeland Security Department's crisis management responsibilities, the FBI and elsewhere, and I wonder if there was an opportunity to address crisis management as a discrete issue.
Okay. Well, let me respond and go back to the comments that Ambassador Dobbins made about bad policy, bad process, and maybe even suggesting bad leadership on some of these issues. And one of the reasons we did the case studies was that lots of people are focused on events of the last 7 or 8 years. With many of these thoughts in mind. If we just had different policy decisions, if we just had different leadership, it wouldn't have come out as poorly as it did. And so we did the case studies to go back to every administration since 1947 Act was passed. And there are instances in which things came out well. Often it depended upon charismatic leadership, which either had the means to pull the system together or more often push the system out of the way. And that can have its own risks. But for the most part, if you thought about it, in the Cold War, in our major task, we didn't need a lot of interagency activity. You know, we had sort of our overarching multi-agency strategy. But for the most part, each agency went off and did its own thing, and we were successful there. But even during the Cold War, when we had to do multi-agency things, such as in Vietnam, we struggled. And the issue we're facing today is that everything that we're doing is incredibly multi-agency, and it has to be done rapidly. And so this leadership is important. Leadership is tremendously important. But it is the judgment of our project that no leaders, no matter how skilled they are or strategically foresighted, can succeed in this system. The price of the system is too great. And so we don't need to choose between good leaders and good organization. We'd like to have the best leaders we could possibly elect, but we also need to make their work much more possible through good organization. And I think our case studies demonstrate that this system is fundamentally flawed, especially for the world that we're facing. It was not able to perform in lots of instances during the Cold War period, but increasingly it has not worked. Now, there are examples, as I've mentioned, where we've had some success really based upon some excellent leadership. This issue of crisis management is a hugely important one. You know, we're sort of proposing, if you look at our scheme, the White House will always have to be involved. So if you look at our recommendation where we get the White House up on high policy, grand strategy, and strategic system management, we will also want them to have the ability to make well-informed decisions in a crisis, but they don't have to be completely consumed by the crisis. You know, and here we're proposing that this be decentralized, you know, create an interagency team, you know, not an interagency committee, to formulate ideas to manage a crisis, and so we're kind of pushing that idea, but we recognize the president and the people around him will need the ability to make those key decisions.
Jim Dobbins, piecemeal reform, or does the system need an overhaul?
Well, I point out that oddly enough, this administration has only faced one crisis that wasn't of its own making in an 8-year period, which was 9/11. And it actually performed quite well. If you look at the response, I mean, you can argue that the counterintelligence effort and the counterterrorism effort that led up to it was inadequate, and I'm not arguing that it wasn't and that there weren't fixes that were necessary and justified. But if you look at the response, it was remarkably competent and effective. And it was largely competent and effective because each agency had a pretty well-defined lane and stayed in the lane. So CIA put together a strategy based on an indigenous faction that we'd had a historical relationship with, established contacts with that, funneled money, provided targeting information to the military, who did the bombing and eventually put in some additional targeteers, and the State Department was in charge of building a coalition of international actors to support that effort, and then conducting the diplomacy to put in place a successor government. And we did it all in about 12 weeks, and we did it because the agencies knew their jobs. They stayed in their lanes. They cooperated effectively. And unfortunately, that degree of cooperation, collegiality, and synergy collapsed almost entirely in the aftermath of the victory. And they immediately fell back to squabbling as soon as the conflict was over. The most acute phase of the conflict. So I think that crisis management per se, if you mean Cuban Missile type crisis or 9/11. Those kinds of things, I think the system's working adequately. Now, that doesn't mean that the efforts to prevent the crisis from occurring were adequate and can't be improved. I won't rehash the argument. I mean, the basic, you know, whether, you know, I'm definitely half full and he's has a half empty glass, and we're approaching it philosophically from different points. But I think we tend to converge, perhaps not totally, but substantially.
Please.
Hi, my name is Allison Slater, formerly of USIP, now part of the Strategic Innovation Group at the company where your headquarters is now based.
Okay.
So good. Joe Bengel is my boss. Two things. First of all, I applaud you on a lot of this. I've been following this for a while, and two of my mentors are part of your group, and I think it's extraordinary and timely and much needed. I particularly like the linking of resources to objectives, the aligning of personnel incentives with strategic objectives, and the idea of teams and training teams with conflict resolution skills, since I have a USIP bias in that. But two things, and that is, it's an incredibly executive branch-centric set of solutions. And the second part of this is the fact that you don't mention the private sector. The reality, and if you look at the guest list today, there are many people from contracting community in the D.C. area who are tremendously involved in national security reform and where a lot of the strategic innovation and strategic planning is happening. How do you propose to deal with the private sector, and where is their place in national security reform?
Okay. Well, in our summary of our recommendations, you know, as we've done our work, especially in our state and local issue team, there was lots of consideration about how do we get the private sector and non-governmental organizations involved. In I guess one of our basic themes is that we need to be much more inclusive in the government. You know, the federal level is not that inclusive of state and local, and then we need to get out to the private and non-governmental. One of our recommendations is to get an arrangement between the federal government in advance with private and non-governmental for the kinds of assistance that they can provide to us. But we're also thinking about, you know, when we create an interagency team, it does not just need to be limited to federal officials. We could have state and local people. We could reach out to private or non-governmental people, get them involved. We need to be much more inclusive in our work. And maybe you've highlighted with your question the fact that we don't give enough emphasis to that in our write-ups or in our recommendations. So we'll need to do that. I should say, as she's mentioning the company Dedica, while our project has been funded in part by the Congress, we actually have got more resources from foundations and from private companies who believe that this needs to occur. And Dedica has given us office space for 35 people out in Ballston. So we've been able to bring our whole core staff together, and we're very grateful for that opportunity.
This may be a little cynical, but I think contractors will follow the money. I think the contractors are going to do their thing, whether they're working for the State Department or the Defense Department or AID or anyone else. I mean, as you know, police training or military training is bounced from agency to agency. The same people are actually doing it; they're just doing it for a different agency. I think that while we're going to have to continue to rely heavily on contractors to perform a lot of functions, the main challenge is increasing the core competency of the federal workforce so that they can adequately oversee and professionally evaluate that kind of work.
Speaking of the private sector.
John Allen, Booz Allen Hamilton, following the money, sir. quick question. You just actually touched on it just a minute there. Is the cultural alignment to make this happen down at the worker bee level? Cultural alignment to make people work together. And number two, did you all address maybe even the generational differences? I mean, the millenniums look at information sharing in Web 2.0 completely different than other generations between the way every day they share information. Just wonder if you'd touch upon how we look at the cultural alignment more than the policy and funding.
Sure. Well, the cultural changes are the ones that have the greatest impact and can lead to success. They're also the hardest to bring about. But it is clear we don't have an interagency culture today. We have separate cultures of the various departments. And we're going to try to do in the interagency what we've done in the Department of Defense, where we've created that joint culture. You know, today, if you go to a combatant command in the Department of Defense, you'll see people wearing four or five different kinds of uniforms. But when they're given a mission, they're not worrying about whether it's Army, Navy, Air Force, or Marine Corps assets that are going to be used. They're really thinking about what does the nation need. And we can produce that interagency culture. And the ideas that we have proposed, especially in the personnel area, are designed to do that. More cross-departmental assignments, the requirement for people to be in the interagency. There'll be more interagency places to go. But there's also a need for the new president to lay out his expectations, what values he thinks that we need to have. The most, I thought a moment ago I was going to be asked the question, if you could only make one change, what would it be? And if you've looked at our project, we look at all of the elements of organizational effectiveness. And one of those, and the one that's at the top of the list, and the one that we're missing in our government, is something called shared values. It's an agreed vision, it's agreement on our missions, and it's an agreement on the principles under which we're going to operate. And if you come to the interagency table, the people who are coming from different departments or even bureaus within those departments have a different set of values. And what we need to do is to begin to shape those shared values. You know, lots of virtual organizations can be hugely effective because they have shared values. And so the cultural part is important. And it's something that we're thinking about. We're trying to shape that for the future. It'll take a while to get there, but eventually we'll have that interagency culture we need.
Well, I certainly agree with the desirability of fostering the kind of interagency culture Jim's talking about and the measures he suggested to do that. And these are based in part on what's been achieved in the military side as a result of Goldwater Nichols, but I think it's also important not to exaggerate the degree to which the military has made a paradigm shift in this regard. We're just completing a history of the occupation of Iraq, looking at the experience of the Coalition Provisional Authority, and one of the things that comes out is how inadequately staffed the Coalition Provisional Authority is. It basically never had more than 50% of its positions filled. But what's absolutely shocking was that CJTF-7, the military command, never had more than 50% of its positions filled. Now, it's not surprising that the Pentagon had a hard time staffing a civilian interagency organization to govern a country, something it had never done before, at least not since the 1940s, and that staffing was a continued problem. But the fact that the military couldn't staff the most important headquarters in the world to its authorized strength is absolutely remarkable, and it simply reflected the Army's resistance to sending more people. Not just the Army, the services, but principally the Army to fill out this staff. So this is not to support everything here, but it's to emphasize what an uphill road it is.
You know, may I just
please
build on this? One of the examples I've used on Capitol Hill, and it's had some impact, is to talk about reconstruction and stabilization in Iraq. And you know, I mentioned interagency teams, and in my view, there was no way the Coalition Provisional Authority could succeed. It was an ad hoc organization with an ad hoc plan, with people who were not prepared, not linked back into the other departments and agencies. And so when I talk to people on the Hill about the power of reform, I say, if at the moment the president had gone to the Department of Defense and asked the department to prepare the war plan for invading Iraq, he would have had an interagency team on reconstruction and stabilization, a team that existed, had all of the experts from the different departments and agencies, and he'd said to that team, put together a plan for reconstruction and stabilization in Iraq, and be prepared to go to Baghdad the moment it's liberated to implement that plan with a team that is well-led, well-manned, empowered, has a budget, linked back into the departments and agencies. Could such a team be created? Absolutely. Could it have been much more effective than the Coalition Provisional Authority? Absolutely. Don't know how ugly Iraq would have been, but we could have created that kind of an organization, and in the future, we'll have to have those organizations ready to go.
Please.
Lou Perlman with RSI. I somewhat resonate with Ambassador Dobbins that I am more sympathetic with the recommendations of this report than I am with its premises. The metaphor for what I'm about to say that keeps coming to mind is Singapore. As you and many people here know, in 1941, Singapore was probably one of the most heavily fortified territories in the British Empire. And yet the Japanese, when they invaded, were able to take the city very quickly because the fortifications and the guns all pointed out to sea. And the Japanese invaded by land and came in through the back door. And analogously, I've had this feeling, as Jim knows, from early on in this project, that there is a gap in the premises of the project. And you raised the point momentarily ago of the vision. As you know, I participated in a group of a couple dozen people at the very beginning of the project, discussing for a day and a half what the vision is of what we think national security means in the 21st century. And I also have not had the opportunity to read the whole report, so maybe my comments are unfair, but I have read the executive summary, and as you know, I've been around the project for a long time. I don't think yet it has adequately addressed or resolved that question. And the concrete implications of what I'm getting to is I think one could posit, given the news of the moment, that the management of Fannie Mae and Freddie Mac, while this project was unfolding, were posing a greater threat to America's national security than the kleptocracy in Iran or the leadership of Al-Qaeda in terms of tangible damage. And we could point to other examples, but I think you see the gist of where I'm going. I don't think the project has really adequately addressed the extent to which what we traditionally think of as domestic policies, as opposed to what we traditionally think of as foreign or national security policies, may in fact pose threats or vulnerabilities to America's national security.
Well, let me respond in that regard. You may know that our guiding coalition mud wrestled for a year and a half on this issue of the scope of national security, a very difficult issue. We know that it needed to be broadened from the very narrow scope we have today. But if you make it so broad, if it's the whole government that's doing national security, then it loses much of its meaning, because you have the problem that when you title something national security, it gets a very special treatment, both in the government, even by the courts. And so if you look at our report, what it basically says, it goes down through the broadening that I've mentioned, beyond security from aggression, into thinking about the impact from natural forces, to thinking about our infrastructure systems. But to get to the point that you're talking about, we recognize that national security depends upon those foundational elements of national power. And so we're proposing a lot more attention to a sound economic policy. All of that debt held by foreigners is a national security issue, but there's also the education dimension of national security that we need to worry about in terms of whether we're going to have the right kinds of skills in our workforce and the ability to develop the technology that's necessary. So we have done that portion of it. And as part of that, you know, we have this broadening, bringing into national security the non-traditional departments and agencies. We propose this idea that in those places there be an assistant to the secretary for national security matters. We're proposing that the national security responsibilities of departments and agencies be specified in law. That currently does not exist for many departments and agencies. So I'm certain that there's a lot more work to be done on this subject, and maybe the project on national security reform doesn't have the final word on it, but it's a subject we've really worked hard and we'll try to inform both the government and the public on that topic.
Let me just quickly say, I didn't mean to say that you had been totally indifferent to this.
Okay.
And I realized that, in fact, that there was efforts to grapple with it. I just think that maybe we need to, as you just said, there's more work that needs to be done.
Right. Oh, I could agree with you on that subject.
Please.
Hi, I'm Nancy Berg. And as a veteran of the Senate Armed Services Committee and the NSC and a lot of the agencies you're talking about, I love this. I think it's very, very good. And I wanted to ask particularly about these interagency teams, because I think that sounds like a very good way to get out of just being reactive. We all spend our days being reactive. And so I was curious about whether the people who are on it are people who have other daily jobs, like you would pick an assistant secretary or something, if there's any formula. It doesn't sound like there's a formula. But whether they would be full-time on this team or whether they would be handling another more general job. I like the idea of the outside people, too, the people outside the government. And whether they would sit in their respective agencies and just this would be part of what they do or all of what they do. And also a little idea of what the subjects are. You said maybe reconstruction and stabilization, and I was wondering if one of the subjects might be conflict prevention. And then the other thing is, how did you handle in your report lessons learned, and might that be, because I think we have never really done a good job on that, and how that might possibly be part of these wonderful interagency teams.
Okay, let me respond to that. Our view is that the team members are all full-time. And they would sit separately. They would not sit over in the White House complex, but they'd be someplace here in Washington where the whole team would be together. And the executive secretary of the President's Security Council would have the responsibility to be able to create a team and house it and support it immediately. You know, when an issue comes up in the United States and we need to respond, we can't take 6 months to pull together a group to do it. We need to be able to do it very, very rapidly. But they would be full-time and they would sit separately. What are the subjects? Well, you can think of lots of subjects that need to be addressed from an interagency perspective, whether it's space or whether it's cyberspace or reconstruction, stabilization, or conflict prevention. It could be lots of those subjects. And we've just sort of said, Mr. President-elect, why don't you select 5 or 7 of these issues that are really priorities for you, and let's get a team of people focused on it so you can make rapid progress. Now, the lessons learned, we actually don't learn lessons. We observe them, but we don't learn them. And this chief knowledge officer could be involved in the lessons learned. One problem we have is we don't have a national security library. The White House can't actually tell you what executive orders are still in effect. And so we have in mind that there be a place for lessons learned, a way of collecting ideas from senior people who are departing, you know, so that we gather from their experience. And so it's this sort of a national security library. But we also have in mind somebody that will analyze interagency operations as they're ongoing. And from that, you can get some lessons learned as well. We need to go from just observing them to actually applying them.
I think there is some utility for teams such as Jim's report suggests, but I do think that interagency planning is more than assembling good ideas. It's assembling commitments from agencies to actually do things. And so I don't think that this can be too far divorced from the actual participation of the agency. The president isn't going to endorse a plan that doesn't have agency buy-in. And a plan that's created by a group that isn't representative of the agencies isn't going to have that buy-in. And so a plan for, you know, the occupation of Iraq, which of course we never had, would have required commitments. How many people is the State Department going to have there on day 10, day 20, and day 30? How many troops? Who's going to do police? Who's going to do military? Who's going to do DDR? Who's going to, you know, fix the electric plants? Agencies need to sign up, commit, set aside funding and money, and have people ready to go. Planning is not an abstract process. It's a process of prior commitment, and that can only be done by the agencies with their participation, and it won't be done over their objections.
Let me take both last questioners together.
Okay. Carlos Rodriguez, I actually don't have a comment. A question, more of a comment. I used to work with Dr. Lam at the National Defense University on the working group structure, the structure working group, so I'm happy to see that the project has progressed. Since then, I've just started my career, so I'm at that low-level worker bee. And just thought, you know, just to give you as a pulse of, I entered my career with thinking about interagency, and what I've observed so far is the culture is not so dire as, you know, some people would think it is. Culture exists within multiple levels, different cultures within the organization, and working with the lower level people, the worker bee level, I think lots of times people think about solving problems, not protecting equities. But there's usually some kind of break, some kind of barrier that prevents them from actually going through all the way. Usually that's some kind of budget consideration. We don't have control over this money, so although we recognize this is a good idea, we can't do this. And so I think that if you can change top-level culture, the lower-level buy-in shouldn't be so bad, because I think it's already moving that direction. And the other comment I wanted to make was just, you know, kind of a passing comment. You mentioned about the I think you were joking. I hope you were joking when you mentioned that this administration has only faced one crisis that was not of its own making. People laughed, and it's Friday, and it's raining, and people need to laugh. But the Katrina response was not of the Bush administration's making, or the Katrina wasn't. The response, I don't think anybody considered that response a very good response, and that was an interagency problem as well. It just speaks to the expanding the scope of the definition of national security. People might not have thought of that as a national security event right off the bat, but it does definitely tend to bring in other things into the discussion.
Let me take you as well.
Thank you.
John Mongan, Department of State. This is lucky because my question is actually kind of dovetail with what he was saying. I wonder if this goes far enough. And I'll take that from the bottom level and the top level. At the bottom level, we have, in the earliest days after September 11, we had Special Forces captains and majors making decisions in Afghanistan that had serious impacts all the way up to the bottom level about who they're going to support, who they're going to work with, what targets they're going to go after, and what priority. That, from a development and diplomatic perspective, we are still dealing with ramifications of to this day. And we've had State Department and AID people also pushed out into distant regions where they are far from the traditional locations where they could get guidance and where they could expect to get a higher level of advice. And, for example, at many of the PRT in Afghanistan, you will have a State Department officer who reports to the embassy in Kabul. The AID officer reports to a different office in that embassy. The agriculture officer reports to a still different office in that embassy. And the military commander gets his orders from a brigade commander who lives hundreds of miles from the embassy and has no similar link to the state and other civilians. At the national level, we've got a belt of crisis in the world that generously maybe starts at Lebanon and runs all the way through to India, and it covers three State Department geographic bureaus, I think about two AID bureaus, and I think three combatant commands. And yes, because by the time you factor in the north, you get UCOM as well. And those three combatant commanders aren't just a drive downtown the way the distance from the state and aid sides are. They live in three different continents. So is it possible that that this does not actually go far enough and that forming a team for specific circumstances just doesn't do it? That I don't know if it's a lot of people need to move back to Washington and real estate prices get to go up again, or if it's we need to be pushing more people overseas so that, you know, maybe all Pacific affairs of the United States government get run out of Hawaii. But to me, I wonder if this actually goes far enough to get the kind of integration it posits that we need.
Thank you, Jen.
Sure.
Please go ahead and add in any final comments you might like.
Okay.
To make.
I have to say, I don't think Katrina qualifies as a national security crisis, which is not to say that it didn't potentially have implications for our national security, just like the collapse of the of the financial system does, but I think you do have to set limits if you're going to structure organizations appropriately. And if the Weather Bureau becomes part of our national security architecture, then you're essentially just making that a substitute for the government. There's nothing left. So I don't dispute that the administration handled Katrina badly. On the other hand, previous administrations have handled comparable acts of God adequately, and so, again, I don't necessarily see this as a fatal flaw in our overall structure, as opposed to poor oversight from the White House and poor personnel policies that led to designation of people, and perhaps the decision to put this within DHS was a mistake. I don't know. I'm not enough of an expert.
Any other comments you want to make, Jim, in concluding? Jim Dobbins?
No.
Jim Locker.
My view is, while we could debate whether Hurricane Katrina was a national security issue, it's the same machinery that we are going to use for national security events in this country. whether it's an improvised nuclear device someplace, and if we didn't like how we handled Katrina, the response to Katrina, if we actually had that kind of a situation in the United States, we are not prepared for it at all. And, you know, just something less like domestic IEDs. You know, we're not prepared for that. We've got this fractured all over our government with no coherence to what we would do or how we would prepare. Now, John Mongan asked the question. He was often a PRT in Afghanistan, so he has lots of expertise on that subject. This is about the first time I've been accused of not going far enough, but I should tell you that, in fact, we have the view that the envelope of what is doable will expand in this next year in which we're debating a new National Security Act. You know, lots of people are shocked by our recommendations, and we didn't want to overdo the shock. But my view is this idea of teams can be expanded upon and other things can be expanded upon. John, what we'd end up doing that might help on the issues you're talking about, if we have that single integrated chain of command in Afghanistan, you know, we're going to bring some of those people closer together. There's also a proposal that all of the departments and agencies would have a common alignment of world regions as a start. There'd be sort of a unified command plan that would be issued by the president that sort of said, your particular interest needs to be subordinated to what architecture serves the nation as a whole best. But there's also this effort, if we went off and we created an interagency team for Afghanistan. And I think Jim's point about the teams still have to remain connected to the departments and agencies. And what normally happens, you know, the team model started in business. It started with Toyota. And when Toyota recognized that they needed to be able to respond quickly to what was going on, but they needed the expertise across the corporation in one team that could move rapidly. But those team members that came from the functional stovepipes had the responsibility of staying linked to their functional area. And because those functional areas are still thinking things, they're learning things, and they have information, and it gets sent to the team through that member. But the team member also goes back to that functional stovepipe and says, here's the bigger picture. Here's the brain power the team is able to put together. And he sells those ideas back to the functional people that brings them along. But there'll have to be mechanisms where a departmental secretary can appeal to the president and say, you know, this team's going to destroy the national interest. But, John, we're working on it. Maybe we don't have all of the ideas for how to get all of this integrated, but I think we've got a great start in that regard. And as my closing comment, I should have said that, you know, I really came here in a recruiting mission. National security reform must happen. Bold transformation of this system. We are headed in the direction of seeing a lot more setbacks. A world that's changing way too fast for the rigid bureaucracy we have, the inability to work. You know, after 3 or 4 years, we can get it sorted out in Iraq, and it took us 6 or 7 years to get it sorted out in Vietnam, and lots of lives and treasure were lost and foreign policy setbacks. To make this happen in Washington is going to be incredibly difficult, especially on Capitol Hill, where they know nothing about the interagency and they know nothing about modern organizational practice. And what I'm asking you, and the reason I came here, is you've shown that you have an interest in this particular subject. And I'm asking you to become part of this huge army that's going to have to move this in Washington. I think we have a great chance with the new administration, but there are all of those thousands and thousands of people who will have to implement these ideas in the executive departments and agencies. And then all of those people on Capitol Hill who will need to be convinced to provide the flexibility to empower the new officials to endorse this in legislation. So I'm asking for your help. We need it. I think we're off to a great start in this project, but it'll take the work of an enormous amount of people to bring this about, but the nation needs it desperately.
Let me ask you to join me in thanking Jim Dobbins for bringing his experience and Jim Locker for the inspiration.